Mason's men had managed to extinguish all the fires and retrieve what bodies they could while the others were underground. The heavy stench still hung over the area, as did a dark cloud of smoke. There was considerable concern that whoever had done this might return, and so the decision was made to continue up the road a bit before finding a place to camp for the night. Jeffries and his men hadn't found anyone else alive in the ruins, and the boy had walked off in the wake of the old man's death. Mason gave the orders, and the teams quickly regrouped, loaded back into the vehicles, and left the shattered remains of Shank behind them as they drove toward the setting sun. About 10 miles farther up the road, they found a nice spot in the lee of a small ridge to set up a camp for the night. A cold wind was pushing down from the north at this point, and the ridge would at least provide some shelter during the course of the night. They had a quick dinner, and then retired to their tents, one for each carload. The excitement of the past few hours was still with them, and so no one wanted to sleep. Davenport was making notes in his journal, chronicling the trip, while Anya stared absently at the map over Mason's shoulder as he tried to figure out their next course of action. A sudden thought occurred to her. She stared at the map for a long moment, following the topographical lines to be certain, before turning to Davenport.
Let me see that parchment that was in the chest.
You figured it out, haven't you?
Maybe. Not sure yet.
Anya took the scrap of parchment from him and unfolded it, making sure she was remembering the design on it properly. Mason was watching her now, along with Davenport, so she reached out and took the topographical map he was holding.
May I?
Be my guest.
She laid it across her knee, then put the piece of parchment against it, comparing the two. After a moment, she looked up at her two companions.
I'm an idiot. It was right here in front of us the whole time.
Anya pointed at the three wavy lines on the piece of parchment.
To where the blood of the world intertwines, and the voice in the earth has its say. It's obvious.
Obvious? Really?
She shook her head, frustrated with her slowness in not seeing it before. She hadn't expected Mason to catch it, but she should have seen it right away.
The Mongols were, at heart, animists. Everything had its own spirit, including the earth. A typical Mongol encampment stank to high heaven, which was one of the reasons the Europeans began calling them the Mongol Horde. But that was because they didn't understand the cultural differences between the two societies. Unlike their European counterparts, Mongol warriors refused to bathe in rivers and streams. This wasn't because they liked being dirty, but because they considered such places to be holy. They saw the land beneath their feet as the body of the earth spirit, so to speak, which meant that the rivers and streams
would be the veins that carried its blood through its body. So if that's the case, what's with the triangle-looking thing?
It's a mountain, or at least I think it's a mountain.
That would be my guess, too. A mountain, which means that all we have to do is find one that stands near the convergence of three rivers and we've found where the blood of the earth intertwines.
Should be easy enough.
The three of them huddled around the map. 15 minutes later, they'd found several different possibilities and had only covered half of the map. Clearly, they were missing something.
How do we know which one is more likely than another?
Well, it would probably be one that was important to the Khan, wouldn't it? Some place that held special meaning for him?
They sat in silence for a few moments, thinking, until Anya suddenly grabbed the map.
Cock Lake! Genghis Khan was named clan chief on the shores of Cock Lake at the foot of Karajurgan Mountain. The Mongol name for it was the Blue Lake, by Backheart-shaped mountain. Just about every single historical account we have about Genghis's life notes this as significant. Well, that's got to be the place.
Cock Lake was fed by two rivers, not three. That started them down a list of major events in the Khan's life, and it wasn't long before they figured it out. The boy, who would later become the Khan of Khans, had been born along the Onon River, near the spot where the Onon, the Tuol, and the Kerulen all began. Looming over them was the tallest mountain in the Hentin Nuru Range, Burkhan Khaldun, or God Mountain, as it was called. Anya pointed to the spot on the map about 3 or 4 days' hard drive from where they were.
That's it. That's the place. It's got to be. That's where we'll find the next clue.
They broke camp with the rising sun and headed north toward the Hentin Nuru mountain range. They kept their vehicles in the same formation, but now everyone paid more attention, both to the traffic they passed on the road and to the clear sky above, looking for the helicopter Ching Bak claimed Ransom had arrived in. It wasn't long before they left the last remnants of civilization behind and headed into the heart of the Mongolian steppes. Anya had seen pictures of spring in the steppes, the vast green plain stretching as far as the eye can see, wildflowers and herds of wild horses occasionally breaking the ocean of green with a riot of color and motion, all framed by the clear blue sky above that just seemed to go on forever. Unfortunately, they were just a few short weeks from winter at this point. Those endless green plains were now dull beige in color. The wildflowers were nowhere to be found, and the horses had gone south for warmer pastures. The blue sky was the same startling color, but even that seemed colder and harsher to Anya than it had in the photographs. Just about midday, they came upon an old chain-link fence stretching across the road and disappearing into the distance on either side. The gate had been forced at some time in the past. It lay bent and pulled to one side, the chain that had once secured it now draped across the road. A sign with Cyrillic letters, pockmarked with bullet holes, hung about 5 feet to the left of the gate.
Restricted zone. Violators will be shot.
They had reached the edge of the land Genghis Khan had called home. Anya knew that after Genghis Khan was secretly buried in his homeland, his soldiers sealed off several hundred miles of pristine countryside. No one but members of the Khan's family could enter. A special group of soldiers was assigned to protect what would become known as the Ik Korig, the Great Taboo. Anya knew that even long after the Mongol Empire had collapsed and other cultures had invaded the area, the Mongol people had still prevented anyone from entering this sacred land. When the Soviets arrived, there was concern that the Mongol people would use the memory of Genghis Khan as a rallying point for nationalism. To prevent this, the Soviets kept up the age-old habit of preventing entry into the region, even going so far as to stop referring to the area by its Mongol name and reclassifying it as the highly restricted area, an innocuous bureaucratic designation if there ever was one. Not satisfied with that, they surrounded the highly restricted area with another equally large buffer zone they named the Restricted Zone. Neither roads nor bridges had been built anywhere within this zone during the Soviet era. With so many other issues occupying the Mongol people's attention, nothing had been built since the collapse of the Soviet Union either. With a wave of his arm, Mason ordered the convoy to continue forward into the Great Taboo. From his position a few miles behind, Ransom sat and watched the blip on his tracking device that represented Davenport's convoy as they crossed into the restricted zone. He wondered exactly where they were headed. His team had struck out twice so far, first with the translation of the journal, and then again at the monastery. Clearly, Davenport and his pet archaeologist knew something he did not. The rear door opened, and Santiago slid into the seat beside him.
Well?
We're set. All we need is the cash to pay them off, and they'll do whatever we ask them to do.
Good. And they know not to touch anything they find.
I made it quite clear.
Oh, excellent.
Ransom turned back to the GPS monitoring device and watched the blip continue on its forward journey.
Let's see how Davenport deals with a little unexpected company, shall we?
The trip became more surreal the deeper they went into the restricted zone. The Soviets might not have wasted their time building bridges or roads, but that didn't mean they shied away from building everything else. The first thing they encountered, less than half a mile from the boundary, was an abandoned tank base. At least, that's what Anya assumed it to be, given the rusting hulks that sat still and silent off to each side of the road and the cluster of buildings they could see in the distance. The tanks looked as if they had been in the midst of maneuvers when the call had come for everyone to drop things where they were and walk off the set. It was an eerie feeling driving by those abandoned tanks. There was a sense of fearful expectation about them, as if they were just waiting for the right stimulus to reawaken. The tanks disappeared into the distance behind them. That was just the beginning of the weirdness, however. They passed a long stretch of flat country filled with craters and strewn with the wreckage of trucks, tanks, and what seemed to be the partial remains of aircraft. Any interest in examining them was quickly stifled when unexploded artillery shells were found in a nearby crater. Collapsed buildings and complexes also showed up regularly along their route, lounging empty and all but forgotten among the waving grasslands. More than once, they were forced to detour around large pools of stagnant water mixed with unidentifiable chemicals that shimmered in the sunlight like Christmas lights. Far more often than not, the banks of such oases were lined with the decaying carcasses of animals that had crept down to the water's edge for a drink and never managed to leave. Even the air seemed to be against them, with strange-smelling vapors rising from the cracked and cratered landscape as they drove farther and farther from civilization. They had been driving for 8 long hours when Mason called a halt. It would be dark soon, and he wanted to have camp set up while they could still see. A quick conference with the other drivers resulted in the choice of a suitable location. The tents were pulled out and set up while two of Mason's men set about making dinner for the rest of the team. The food was good, and the coffee afterward even better. Anya found that she enjoyed Mason's company, and the two of them stayed up much later than the others, swapping stories. Anya talked about the various expeditions she'd been on and what it was like working on a popular cable show, while Mason filled her in on all the craziness that came with being the personal bodyguard to one of the world's richest men. By the time they were both ready to call it an evening, it was close to midnight. Mason banked the fire, ensuring that there would be hot coals to restart it in the morning, and they both retired to their tent. Anya, however, was unable to sleep. She'd had too many cups of coffee after riding in the truck all day, and nature called. She really didn't want to go outside in the cold, but sharing the tent with two men didn't leave her any other option. Trying to be as quiet as possible so that she didn't wake her companions, she dug around in her pack until she located the packet of tissues she'd set aside for just such an event, and then, flashlight in hand, stepped out into the night air. The moon had yet to rise, and the camp was shrouded in darkness. But she refrained from turning on the flashlight, as she didn't want to call attention to herself should anyone still be awake. She figured she'd get beyond the ring of trucks at the edge of camp and then switch it on. The dying embers of the fire gave her enough light to see by, and so she crossed past its remains, headed for the trucks parked just beyond. Anya froze.
A horse? Way the heck out here?
She waited, her pulse rising and her ears straining, trying to decide if she'd heard what she thought she'd heard or if she'd simply been imagining it. A few seconds passed, and she had just about decided it must have been something else. Anya lowered herself into a crouch and quietly transferred the flashlight to her left hand. The hair on the back of her neck was standing upright, and adrenaline flushed her system as she realized that the camp was more than likely surrounded.
Whoever they aren't here to welcome us to the neighborhood.
A huge form came rushing out of the darkness. A club swung at her. She hit the ground, rolled, and came back up on her feet.
Mason!
The rider in front of her reined in his mount and turned around for another try at her. Anya waited until the last possible second, then flicked on her flashlight and shone it at the rider's face. Anya thrust upward with her sword. Two more men ran out of the darkness. One with a curved sword, one with a tire iron. She took the fight to them. Just as Anya closed with the man with the sword, the scene around her was flooded with light. Someone must have shot off a flare. She could see the faces of the men in front of her now. Hard Mongol faces with even harder expressions. She traded several blows with her opponents, still maneuvering to keep the two of them in front of her where she could see them both. The Mongol's sword was lighter than her own, but shorter as well. He'd obviously used the weapon in the past, but he made a fatal mistake, taking a half second too long to recover from a thrust that disturbed his center of gravity. Anya knocked his sword to the ground, then she kicked him in the knee and hit him in the temple with the flashlight. The second man suddenly rushed toward Anya. Ah! Anya instinctively threw herself to the ground, scrambling to find cover, but finding only the body of her dead assailant to hide behind.
Anya!
I'm here!
Mason and his men stood in a loose circle in front of her tent, with Davenport in their center, guarding him quite literally with their bodies. Between her and the rest of the team were the bodies of almost a dozen Mongol men and two of the horses they had ridden on. They were all dead, the majority gunned down in mid-assault by Mason's men as they had reacted to Anya's warning cry and rose to defend their employer. Anya herself had accounted for three of them, including the one she'd struck with the flashlight. It had been close. If she hadn't needed to use the bathroom, things might have turned out rather differently. Mason rushed over to her, anxious for her safety, and as he came toward her, Anya made sure to release her sword. Suddenly exhausted, she climbed to her feet in time to meet Mason.
Are you all right?
Without waiting for an answer, he took hold of her upper arms and turned her body this way and that, looking for injuries. His concern surprised her. There seemed to be more here than just an expedition leader worried about one of his people. It also made her a little uncomfortable. He must have sensed it, too, for he abruptly let her go with a smile. Unfortunately, not everyone had escaped unscathed. Both Harris and D'Angelo had been wounded and needed medical attention. Kent did what he could with the medical kits they had in the vehicles, but he wasn't sure if they could continue the journey, given the extent of their injuries. If their conditions grew any worse in the next 24 to 48 hours, he recommended that they return to Ulaanbaatar, where they could be treated properly. While Mason was talking to Kent, the others had stoked the fire back into a roaring blaze to provide some warmth, and then turned the trucks around so that the headlights were pointed into their camp, giving them the light they needed to conduct a search as they sought to understand who had attacked them and why. Jeffries and Williams dragged the bodies into a line near the fire. Then Anya and Mason went over to them one at a time under Davenport's watchful gaze. While they did that, Jeffries, Vale, and Williams did a quick canvas of the area around the camp, just to be certain there weren't any more attackers lingering in the perimeter. Their assailants had all been Mongol men, locals it seemed. Their clothes were mostly handmade and had been repaired more than once. Their weapons were traditional as well, clubs and hatchets and scimitars. But the money in their pockets was new, and more telling, it was foreign. American dollars, crisp and shiny, as out of place as a whale in a jewelry shop. Putting it all together, they came up with what would have been considered a paltry sum back home.
$100. They were willing to kill us for $100 lousy bucks.
It must have been ransom.
But how? How is that bastard tracking us so effectively? How does he know where we are all the time?
The same thought occurred to them both.
The trucks!
It took them almost 2 hours, but they finally found the transponders hidden in a crevice in the well of the spare tire in each of the vehicles. One by one, they were carefully removed and laid out beside one another on a folding table Davenport had taken from their tent. They were small, rugged units, designed for use in harsh environments, and they probably would have gone undetected if it hadn't been for the failed attack and the recognition that someone else besides the bandits themselves were behind the assault. Anya wanted to destroy them at once, but Mason overruled her. He called Jeffries and ordered him to see if he could round up any of the horses the bandits had been riding. He borrowed a piece of paper from Anya and tore it into three long strips. He quickly wrote something on each, then wrapped them around the listening devices. By that time, Jeffries was back with the horses, and Mason dropped one of his little packages into the saddlebags on each horse. For the time being, the horses were tied to the front grills of the vehicles to keep the animals from roaming during the night. Mason intended to make good use of them come morning. After untying the horses and letting the animals roam where they wanted, they continued on, making their slow way across the shattered landscape. They hoped it would take Ransom a while to discover the ruse, and by then they would be well on their way to their next destination. They hadn't made much distance by midday, and any hopes of making up the time lost quickly disappeared when the road petered out shortly thereafter. One minute it was there, the next it disappeared from beneath their wheels, and they discovered that they had reached the limit of human expansion, at least in this day and age. As a result, their pace slowed even more. On the bright side, they began to see returning signs of life in the landscape around them as they left the road farther and farther behind. First, it was just the occasional small bush, hardy little plants that could withstand the climate of the polluted area to the south. Then, bushes and grasses began to show up with more regularity. Scrub, rye, sagegrass, and the like. Until the land ahead of them became carpeted in vegetation. Mid-afternoon brought them to a wide-open plain on which a massive herd of gazelle grazed. They scattered as the trucks moved among them, and at one point Mason sped up alongside the racing beasts, clocking their speed at just under 35 miles an hour. Anya knew that they were going to have fresh meat for dinner that evening. As the herd raced ahead, Mason brought the truck over a gentle rise, and there ahead of them loomed the Hentine Nuru Mountains, tall, snow-capped peaks that rose in a ragged line that stretched out toward the horizon. In their midst was one that was larger and more prominent than the rest, Burkhan Khaldun, God Mountain. Mason let the truck roll to a stop, and Anya climbed out for a moment. There weren't too many Westerners who had the opportunity to see what she was seeing, and she took her time savoring the view. Somewhere amid those peaks and valleys, the greatest warrior the world had ever seen had been laid to rest more than 8 centuries before, and she was determined to find him. It was at that point that they ran into a problem with their local guides. Up until then, Nambai, and by extension his grandson, had been keeping them on track, even after the road had stopped and they had been forced to cut across country. But now, with the mountains looming ahead of them, Nambai had a change of heart. He refused to take his grandson any farther into the heart of the Ikkorig. When questioned, he mumbled something about a dream he'd had the night before, in which the spirits told him that none of them would return alive from such a trip. He was willing to risk his own life and those of the foreigners who had paid him, but he would not risk the life of his daughter's child. Neither talk nor threats could change his mind. Even Cook Botter's pleading didn't work. The man clearly believed what he had seen was an omen, and nothing was going to alter that fact. Mason paced in frustration, venting his anger on anyone who got too close. Turning back wasn't an option. They had come too far to have to backtrack and then retrace their route. Ransom was sure to get ahead of them if they were forced to do so, and that was simply unacceptable. But Mason couldn't leave the young man there to await their return either. Recent events had clearly shown that those on their tail were willing to kill to stop them from reaching their goal, and Cook Bator would be a prime target for them. Finally, he stopped pacing and pulled Kent to one side.
How are our wounded doing?
Kent glanced over at the truck where the two men were resting.
Harris is doing okay. The knife wound he took to the shoulder seems to be responding decently to the sulfur powder, and it hasn't started bleeding again, which is a good sign. D'Angelo, on the other hand, is a mess.
Can he go on?
Not if you want him to have use of that leg for the rest of his life. That hatchet must have been dirty as hell, because I can't get a hold on the infection, and I'm afraid it's going to spread. If it does, he'll wind up losing the leg before we make it back to civilization.
All right. Thanks.
Mason clapped the other man on the shoulder to let him know that it wasn't his fault that the news wasn't good. Things go wrong sometimes on an op. That's just the way it goes. D'Angelo's medical condition made Mason's decision easier, though. Because Kent was trained as a medic, Mason ordered him to take one of the trucks and accompany Harris, D'Angelo, and Cook Bator back to the city. In the meantime, the rest of them would continue on in the other two vehicles. That would give the wounded men the medical care they needed and satisfy Mason's obligation to Nambai, all in one fell swoop. It was the best he could do under the circumstances. They divvied up the supplies, making sure both groups had what was needed to continue on their way. Farewells were exchanged, and with a last parting wave, Kent and his crew piled into their truck and headed back toward Ulaanbaatar and civilization. The rest of the group continued on. Mason, Davenport, Anya, and Nambai were in the lead truck now, with Jeffries, Williams, and Vale bringing up the rear in the other, The carcass of the antelope Vale had managed to bring down, tied to the roof. As the day grew longer, they left the plains behind and, after passing through a region of rolling hills, began to climb through a series of interconnected alpine valleys. They were slowly gaining in elevation as they went, and the air took on a bit of a chill, causing several of them to break out warmer clothing. Near the end of the day, they came upon a pristine mountain lake, and despite the bone-chilling temperature of the water, they all took the opportunity to take a quick dip and wash up. The men went first, laughing and roughhousing the whole time, and then Anya took a turn, with Mason standing guard. Afterward, they hung out their freshly washed clothes to dry and enjoyed antelope steaks and fresh fish that night for dinner as the sun dipped over the horizon. It was almost enough to make Anya forget what they'd been through the previous evening. Almost. Ransom paced back and forth in the large Quonset hut he was using as his temporary headquarters, his irritation growing as the clock ticked onward. He turned to where Santiago sat in front of their communications equipment.
Any word from our new friends?
Warily, Santiago shook his head.
What the hell is keeping them?
I don't know. Maybe they're still mopping things up.
All right, give them another hour.
But when they hadn't reported in at the end of that time, Ransom's patience had worn thin.
I'm tired of waiting around for someone else to do our work for us. Do we still have them on the trackers?
Santiago spun the laptop that was sitting on the table in front of him in Ransom's direction. Three bright red dots marked the location of the three vehicles. Near as Ransom could tell, they hadn't moved much since the night before. There they were, still clustered near one another in the same general place.
How fast can the chopper be ready?
5 minutes, sir.
Let's pay them a visit.
10 minutes later, they were airborne and headed toward the rendezvous with their unsuspecting enemies. The chopper could cover the territory much faster and more efficiently than the trucks Davenport's men were using, and so it didn't take long to get into position. Ransom held the laptop containing the tracking software on his lap, providing instructions to the pilot, while Santiago cradled his rifle in his arms, making certain the weapon was ready for action when he needed it.
No more screwing around.
It didn't take long for their targets to grow closer on the screen.
Santiago, remember what I said?
Yes, sir. Quick, clean shots. Minimum damage to the vehicles, if at all possible, but collateral damage to the occupants is acceptable, even preferred, regardless of whether it is the tribesmen we hired or Davenport's team.
The targets were less than a mile out, and Ransom gave the signal for the pilot to take it lower. He didn't want to give them any more warning than was necessary. The pilot took the chopper down low, and behind him, Ransom felt Santiago slide open the side door and ready himself for what was to come.
Screw you, Davenport. Time for this little game to come to an end.
Ransom thought back to that day when Davenport had discovered his activities on the building project. If they had finished the building the way he had planned, they would have saved $11 million in construction costs alone. So what if the structural engineers had claimed the building wouldn't hold together long term? He'd have found another inspection firm who would have said the exact opposite. All that mattered was the money they were making. But Davenport hadn't agreed. Ransom had been humiliated, and now he intended to return the favor. He'd be known worldwide as the man who found the lost tomb of Genghis Khan, and Davenport would be buried in a shallow grave in the middle of East Nowhere, right where he belonged. A glance at the trackers showed that their targets should be just over the next rise. Anticipation surged in his veins.
Get ready.
Like an avenging angel, the helicopter crested the ridge, and Ransom looked through the windscreen, searching for the trucks on which the bugs had been planted back in Ulaanbaatar. At first, all he could see was brown scrub grass. Then the herd of wild horses that had been grazing on it burst into motion, surging left and right as they sought to escape the thunder of the mechanical bird above them.
Where are the trucks?
Ransom didn't know. Confused, he looked down at the tracker, noting that it showed all three of them almost directly below the helicopter. He pointed at the screen with his finger.
They should be down there.
But all they saw was horses. Ransom peered carefully down into the herd below him, looking for a sign, something to confirm what he suddenly suspected. A horse split off from the herd, the saddle on its back now clearly visible. The blip on the screen, representing the tracking bug, sliding away to the left, just like the animal below them. Enraged, Ransom clambered in the back and grabbed the rifle from a bewildered Santiago. It took him a couple of tries, but eventually one of his shots went true, and the horse toppled forward to lie still in the grass. The pilot landed near the wounded horse. Ransom got out, Santiago at his heels. The horse was still alive, though just barely, when they reached it. Ransom didn't care. All he wanted was to prove his suspicions were correct. Ignoring the animal's labored breathing, he dug around in its saddlebags until he found a folded piece of paper in which his tracking transponder had been placed. Drawn on the inside of the scrap of paper was a smiley face. Without another word, he turned and stalked back to where the helicopter was waiting.
That's it. This time the bastard dies.
Davenport and the rest of the team awoke to find a thin coating of snow covering everything in sight. It was less than half an inch deep, barely worth worrying about, and certain to melt before the morning was over. But for Anya, it was a reminder that their time here was limited. Winter was coming, and once it arrived, it would mean the end of their search for 6 long months or more. They were going to get one shot at this, and that was it.
Better make it count.
They broke camp quickly and got underway, the knowledge that they were close to their destination spurring them on. In the light of day, they were able to see that the density of the forest on the far side of the valley was not going to allow them to continue with the trucks. So supplies were transferred to backpacks, and the group continued on foot. If all went according to plan, they would return to the trucks after finding the voice of the earth and figure out their next move from there. They hiked upward into the trees for a couple of hours, taking a brief rest along the way to gulp down a cold lunch and rejuvenate their systems. It was shortly after that that they emerged into a clearing about a third of the way up the mountain and were given the first chance they'd had to see what lay ahead of them. Nambai pointed at a near vertical wall of dark stone that loomed above the trees a short distance away.
There, the birthplace of the river is at the foot of that mountain.
He went on to explain how he had come here several years before, hunting eagle chicks to sell in the market in the city, and had seen where the river bubbled up from the base of the mountain, as well as where it diverged into 3 separate waterways shortly thereafter.
How much farther is it?
Not far.
Apparently, not far in Mongolian, translated to within 20 miles in English. They climbed upward through the dense tree cover, using saplings to pull themselves forward when the trail, or lack thereof, became too steep. Just when Anya's legs started screaming for release, the group emerged from the trees to see the river rushing past them, perpendicular to their line of travel. Upriver, to their left, the sheer face of the cliff wall rose from the forest floor like some looming giant, ready to squash them at the slightest provocation. Nambai led them in that direction without comment. Once they were close enough, they could all see that a raging torrent spilled out from under the base of that mammoth wall, bubbling up from somewhere deep beneath their feet. A few hundred yards downstream, it split into 3 distinct rivers, the Onan, the Tul, and the Kerulen. They all had their common origins in that single waterway, surging past their feet. Davenport gathered the group around him.
All right, this is it. This is the place we've been looking for. I want you all to spread out and start looking around. We're searching for something referred to as the voice in the earth. But that's all I can tell you about it, so look for anything unusual, any sign of human habitation, that kind of thing, okay?
The rest of the team nodded their understanding, then split up and began covering the surrounding area. Wanting a little time to herself to think, Anya strode off on her own before anyone else could volunteer to accompany her. She had to admit that she was surprised by the beauty of the place. As she walked along the riverbank, she was able to relax for the first time in days. The trees around her swayed in a gentle breeze that had kicked up shortly after they had arrived. And though it made things a little colder, the air seemed fresher, the smells richer because of it. But after half an hour, without finding anything, she gave up and returned to their starting place at the base of the cliff. Anya found a relatively flat rock to stretch out on and sat down, letting the afternoon sunlight warm her as she went back over everything in her mind.
The answer is here somewhere. I just have to ask the right questions.
She must have dozed off a little in the peace of the moment, for something intruded on her consciousness. She jerked upright, suddenly aware of how quiet the forest around her had become.
Mason? Mr. Davenport?
The air held an expectant feeling, ripe with tension, as if the forest around her were holding its breath, waiting for something to happen. She reached out into the otherwhere, made sure she could get her sword if she needed it. It was there, as it always was, waiting for her touch to bring it to life. But she didn't draw it just yet. There would be time for that. She was just about to call out for her companions a second time. Anya jumped in surprise, her skin rising in goosebumps, the hair across her body standing on end. Somehow, Anya knew it would continue getting softer until she wouldn't be able to hear it at all. She had to find its source before that happened. Anya scrambled back to the point where the water surged up from beneath the cliff face, her gaze flashing frantically about, her ears straining.
Come on. Come on, just one more time.
She caught movement out of the corner of her eye, but she dared not turn away, dared not miss the opportunity, for who knew when it would come again.
Anya!
One more time, please.
This time, she was ready for it, standing as she was directly in front of the wall when the sound issued from it. She saw that it came from a small hole about the size of her fist, a hole that was at shoulder height, and luckily for her, on her side of the stream. Davenport and Mason rushed over to her side. Williams and Vale weren't too far behind.
Did you hear that?
Anya barely heard the question. Guided by some inner sense she couldn't define, she watched as if from afar as she put her hand inside the hole and pushed. A section of the stone a few feet away rolled slowly to one side, revealing an opening large enough for several of them to fit through at once. Anya started toward it, but Mason stopped her with a hand on her arm.
Hang on a second. We do this the smart way.
He pulled a pair of high-intensity flashlights out of his pack, keeping one for himself and handing the other to her. Together, they stepped through the opening. The door opened up into some kind of antechamber, complete with benches around the perimeter and niches in the wall for storing items. There was a door directly across from the one they'd entered, and even in the dim light of their flashlights, they could see that it led down a short tunnel and opened into a large space just beyond. A sconce holding a torch hung on either side of the door, and they paused a moment to light them, noting from the dust and cobwebs that neither torch had been lit in many years. Ages, even. The torchlight flickered off the stone and sent their shadows chasing after them as they continued.
Looks clear.
Davenport walked through the entry. Jeffries and Nambai came in as well, leaving Williams and Vale to guard the entrance and to watch for any sign that Ransom might be onto them again. Once the others were inside, Anya and Mason continued on. They quickly found that the short hallway opened into another room, though this one was much larger than the first. They could see darkness pooling out beyond the edge of their torchlight, indicating there was more to uncover. But they barely paid any attention to that fact as soon as they got a glimpse of what had been drawn across the floor in the center of the room. It was a map. It had been painted on the floor and was partially obscured by years of dust and dirt, but it was clearly recognizable as such. With specific instructions from Anya, everyone got down on their hands and knees and gently brushed the loose debris off the painting, exposing it all for perhaps the first time in centuries. Once they were finished, they stood back to examine what they had uncovered.
Not the handiest thing to use in finding your way around.
Maps needed to be portable in order to be useful, and this was anything but. Still, you didn't create a map of this size and then hide it away from the rest of the world if there wasn't a point to it. There was a reason it was here. Like many ancient maps, this one was more a general representation of the surrounding area than a scale drawing. In some ways, that made it easier to read. The blue line that split in three and stretched down toward the bottom of the map obviously represented the three rivers. The round circle, with the three squiggles running out of it near the source of the river, must represent the voice in the earth. and the tall peak rising above the others could only be Burkhan Khaldun, God Mountain. The entire map had been produced at a huge scale, so that you literally had to walk from one side of the chamber to the other in order to see it all. Anya was still doing just that, working her way slowly from the lower section of the map, which represented the area they had traveled through the day before, toward the summit of God Mountain, the most likely place for Genghis Khan's tomb to be located. She was determined not to miss anything significant.
Anya, come quickly!
Davenport was standing roughly two-thirds of the way up the slope of the large black triangle that represented Burkhan Khaldun and waving to her frantically. Anya headed over to see what the commotion was about.
So much for meticulousness.
A symbol had been drawn on the map, a crude sketch of a woman riding a horse, and next to it were words in a fine, flowing script that looked to be Mongolian. Anya couldn't decipher it, but it turned out Nam Bai could.
The 60, I think that translates as brides, rode 60 horses and now sleep under the, I'm not sure what that word is, eyes of those who came before.
In their arms is the truth you seek, the way to all that was and more.
It was an exact match to the hidden message Anya had uncovered in Curran's journal. Nam Bai looked at the script.
That's right. How did you know?
It's a long story.
Mason went on to explain about the message hidden in Curran's journal. While he did that, Anya squatted down, letting her fingers trace the outline of the symbol on the map, as she realized that they were one step closer to their goal. The symbol put the Tomb of the Virgins on the south slope of Burkhan Khaldun, which couldn't be more than a day's hike north of their current position.
You'd have to ask Anya.
Ask me what?
Nambai wants to know what the whole brides and steeds thing means.
Anya stood and brushed off her hands on the legs of her jeans.
Right. Well, my theory ties the riddle back to the things we know about the Khan's burial. When Genghis died, he was in China with his army. Not wanting to bury his body among his enemies, his generals had it transported back to his homeland with an honor guard of 60 warriors. The guard traveled ahead of the funeral train, so in essence, they could be said to have come before Genghis. Once the procession reached the place in the Great Taboo where they intended to bury him, the entire honor guard was slaughtered down to the last man.
That's what they get for volunteering.
Anya ignored Mason. She noted that she had Davenport's and Jeffrey's attention now as well.
Along with the honor guard, 60 virgins and 60 of the finest horses were sacrificed to provide the Khan with a harem and a herd for all eternity. Legend states that they were all buried together in a magnificent tomb, commonly referred to as the Tomb of the Virgins, but its exact location has always been a mystery because those who did the burying were themselves slaughtered to keep the secret safe. If I'm right, the phrase, "the way to all that was and more," means that we'll find the next clue inside that tomb.
Anya pointed to the symbol of the woman on the map near Davenport's feet.
And that tells us where to find it. Come on, I'll show you.
She led them all back outside and pointed up at the looming peak of Burkhan Khaldun. The mountain was far higher than the rest of those around it, making it easy to locate. And even from here, they could see the deep snow that covered most of its face.
That's where we'll find the Tomb of the Virgins, and ultimately where we'll find Genghis Khan's final resting place.
The horsemen, hidden in the trees higher on the ridgeline above the river, watched the intruders enter the Chamber of the Winds and felt anger grow in his heart.
The chamber is sacred. How dare they defile it with their presence?
He'd been following the group ever since they'd entered the Ik-Korig, just as he'd been ordered to do. But this was the first time since they'd come into the Forbidden Territory that they'd done something so unexpected that he wasn't certain how to respond. He'd been told to watch, but not interfere. He couldn't believe that included sitting back and allowing them to do this. He wasn't certain, and it was uncertainty that stayed his hand. That, and the guns the intruders carried openly. He chose to wait and watch, to see if he could determine what they wanted, so that when he reported back, he wouldn't look like a fool. The watcher was still there when the intruders emerged from the chamber almost an hour later and pointed north toward the looming peak of Burkhan Khaldun.
It's time to tell the voice of the wolf.
Darkness came early, thanks to the looming cliff face at their backs and the high trees surrounding them. Rather than try and blunder about in the dark, the decision was made to stay right where they were and use the antechamber for that night's camp. It would provide excellent cover should Ransom fly over in his chopper, something Mason saw as fairly likely. The extra meat they'd cooked the previous night was passed around and eaten cold, but no one complained. They were happy to be out of the tents for a change, and the closeness of the rock around them locked in their body heat, creating a comfortable, if cramped, little haven for the evening. A watch was set up, with Mason, Williams, Jeffries, and Vale taking 3-hour shifts in that order. Each man was to position himself a short distance downriver in the hope that the extra time they would gain with an advance warning might be enough for the others to escape into the nearby woods if it became necessary. After dinner, Anya wandered over to where Mason was setting up his bedroll, getting everything ready before he went on watch.
Do you think Ransom is still looking for us?
Without a doubt. He's like a dog with a bone. Either gets what he wants, or he destroys it so no one else can have it.
The stench of burning flesh rose in Anya's memory, and she shook it off with an effort. It made her uneasy to think Ransom was out there somewhere, plotting how to get back into the game.
Do you think we've lost him?
Mason must have heard something in her voice.
Do you know something I don't?
Anya shook her head. She didn't know anything. She just had an uneasy feeling that something wasn't right. They'd missed something, and she wasn't sure what.
We've lost him for the time being, but I don't expect for it to stay that way for long. He'll find us again, eventually. Best I can do at this point is keep us moving at a steady pace and help you get there before he does.
Mason looked around at the rest of his charges as they prepared to bed down for the night, and then looked back at Anya.
I think we're okay for tonight. Why don't you get some rest and we can talk about it later?
All right.
She began to lay out her own bedroll, all the while wondering what it was they were missing. The smell of frying antelope brought her out of her sleep the next morning. Mason was rolling up his bedroll just a few feet away.
Good morning.
Anya turned away with just a quick nod and went to splash some water on her face and get a plate of food. Antelope strips weren't as good as bacon, but they were a lot better than the powdered eggs she'd been eating for the past few days. The group packed up quickly. They sealed off the entrance to the map chamber by tripping the hidden lever in the same way Anya had opened it, and headed out. That morning's travel was the hardest yet. Their route took them higher into the mountains, along narrow trails that Nambai said were made by Argali, the wild mountain sheep whose curved horns were prized for their supposed magical properties. The air grew colder as they climbed higher, and Anya found herself wishing for the warmer temperatures of the steppes. The forest grew thicker as they climbed. The trees rose around them like silent guardians, watchful and aware. Mixed through the evergreens were patches of birch, bringing flashes of white to all that green, and heightening the sense that they weren't alone, that out there among the trunks, some ancient guardian was keeping score. And Anya almost expected one to come strolling out of the shadows between the deeper trunks. In the early afternoon, they found their first indication that they were not alone. They emerged from a particularly thick copse of trees to find Nambai standing in the middle of a trail cutting its way northward through the forest. In the middle of the trail were fresh horse tracks.
What do you think?
Not good. Could be the Dark Hats.
Who or what are the Dark Hats?
Nambai refused to say anything more.
Legends say that after Genghis Khan's body was returned from China and hidden away forever from the sight of man, a small group of warriors were designated to keep watch over the great Khan's tomb for all time. When one died, the duty fell to his son and that man's son, and so on down through the centuries. Anyone brave or foolish enough to enter the great taboo in search of the tomb would be punished by death. The warriors were known as the Dark Hats.
And people still believe this stuff?
Anya watched Nambai, who hadn't taken his eyes off the woods around them.
Some people do.
Mason gave their guide an odd look and then moved off to talk with his employer. After some discussion between the two of them, the decision was made to follow the trail they had found, horse tracks or not. It was easier than winding their way through the trees and would require less hacking at the undergrowth, which had the added benefit of conserving their strength for when they might actually need it. The trail was wide enough to manage two horses riding abreast, and to Anya, it indicated the presence of much more than just a solitary horseman. But despite keeping a careful watch, she didn't see any evidence that they were being followed. Nor did she find any indications that anyone else was out in the primeval forest with them. Until they came to the burial ground.